that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. By the time you're hearing this week's show, you will undoubtedly have seen everything from animations to puppet shows inspired by the final episode of Breaking Bad. So we'll touch on that just briefly and focus on what it taught us about good guys, bad guys, tuning in and tuning out. Then we'll pivot to the world of games, where, as you may know, a major new release has been kicking around and, spoiler alert, one of us has played it. We'll chat a little about games and gaming and shooting and driving, and as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
Oh, I assign and edit movie reviews, and occasionally I write a little bit.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, I know that Glenn and I are both Breaking Bad people.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen and Trey, Trey is, I think, perhaps not necessarily going to ever be a Breaking Bad person. Stephen, I know, has a dream of
one day.
Trey, are you too a dreamer?
I have actually finished, what is it, the first two seasons right up until the episode where...
So I'm sorry, you're much farther than Stephen. I didn't realize.
I watched right up into the episode where Uncle What's-His-Name and the bell.
Yep. Gotcha.
And then I sort of put it on the shelf for a while.
Sure, that makes sense. I misjudged you. So what we're going to try to do, what I think we should
So what I ask is don't say anything about Breaking Bad after like the first four episodes for the next, give me like 5 years.
Yeah, okay. Right, sure.
So we did want to touch on it, but we understand that there are also many of you. You know, it continues to really be a show with some growth, interestingly enough. People are still streaming it on Netflix, picking it up, watching it from the beginning. And so we do want to respect that. And so I think what we should do is we can talk sort of very thematically about the issues that are raised by trying to bring a series like this to a close.
Sure. Or we could just tell people just to read your thing on the blog. Or we could just do that.
Yeah. Well, here's what I do want to say. For me, the thematic considerations of the finale reflected the thematic considerations of the entire show, mm-hmm. which were basically a person who, in this case, Walter White, who is not a very good guy by the end of the show, but certainly has his shreds of humanity. And you have to balance what storytelling you do about the entire guy, how you serve the idea of him being not a very good guy, how you serve the idea of these shreds of humanity, what kind of an ending you want for him, how much of his own fate you want him to control. Really, all these things feed into how satisfying you find the finale. And I will warn you before we start here. It is Monday as we tape this. The finale was last night. I had a pretty dispiriting day. because one of the other things that came up out of this show, and we did want to talk a little bit about the complexities of good guys and bad guys and complex storytelling. Although I love the show, the finale was not one of my favorite episodes. I wasn't as satisfied by it as some people were. And unfortunately, expressing that made for a very unpleasant day. And so one of the things that it was making me think about is that I find myself increasingly feeling like I'd rather just write about House Hunters. Mm. I'd rather just talk about House Hunters because my level of exhaustion with the way some of these conversations go undermines my interest in complicated storytelling in popular culture because I get so weary from how binary these conversations become. Either something is the best thing ever or the worst thing ever, and there's very little gray area. So I will caution that I'm a little bruised today.
I have to say, I gotta say, Holmesy, I'm way behind on this show, and I have loved what I've seen of the show, and I'm delighted that it's over, and in part because it seems like it is a complete piece of art, mm-hmm. but also in part because the tone mm-hmm. of particularly Twitter and the people I follow universally delightful people on mm-hmm. Twitter, but the tone of Twitter is insufferable during this show. It's like people are smug about watching it.
Yeah.
I don't want to make that the topic. I'm just saying that as I think about, because the funny thing is one of the things I really like about complex storytelling is you can have these really cool conversations about it. up to a point. And then it's almost like it starts to turn in on itself. And I really do get to that point where it's like, I love complexity. I love, you know, I've loved some of the anti-hero shows of the past. I love some of the anti-hero shows of the present. And yet you get to the point where it's like, is this really worth it? Should they just bring back old school Law and Order and just forget the whole thing? Like, not that that doesn't have its moments, but like, I don't know.
Just because of the nature of the discussions of it?
Yes.
Because there's less temptation for people to just dig a trench and stand in it and shoot.
Well, yeah. Part of what I, you know, and again, not to make this the topic, but there was this real like, everything else that is not this should be ashamed that it is not this.
Right.
Yeah.
That I think is silly. I mean, this piece of art should be celebrated as a great mm-hmm. piece of art. But I do think the nature of a lot of the discussions and a lot of the media that we use to discuss these things are much more beneficial when they're used to discuss things that are stupid.
Right.
Right. And that Twitter is an absolute national treasure when we're talking about the VMAs
or the Bachelor
or the Grammys or the Bachelor mm-hmm. or
the Super Bowl.
Or the Super Bowl. That is not the Super Bowl. Things that are lighter, but things that frankly the episodes of this show I have watched are so engrossing that the notion of sitting, I know there are commercials and I'm sure a lot of the tweeting is going on during the commercials, but it seems like it's not something that benefits from having 20% of your attention fixated on something else anyway.
Sure. I think social media has found its own level more with lowbrow culture than highbrow culture so far, to be honest, in the instant part of social
media. And I had very specific reactions to the show that we cannot discuss because they are so specific. So, but let's widen out if we could to one thing. I held this character, Walter White, to a higher moral standard than I held Tony Soprano and anybody on The Wire. And I want to throw this out to the panel
because
I'll take my answer off the air because both The Sopranos and The Wire introduce an infrastructure of violence, an infrastructure of crime and destruction that these characters are sort of born into,
yes.
and they slip into it. And the volition that happens is to get out of it.
Right.
Otherwise, they just sink into, and many of these characters, especially in The Wire, don't have the agency to get out.
Right.
So this is where they go.
Totally.
Walter White is a very different case where he initiates all this destruction. He makes a choice because, and I don't want to make this all about class, but he has the wherewithal, he has the education to make the choice he makes and subsequently destroy the lives of everyone around him.
He even has an out in the first few episodes. Someone offers him a chance to go another way.
Right.
Well, and
there's a moment that Vince Gilligan himself has described as a deus ex machina moment that Walter White passes up.
Yeah. Well, he does that several times.
There is a sense in a show like this, and I think you talked about issues of class. There is a sense with Breaking Bad of there, but for the grace of my own decision making, go I.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And now, you know, I'm not a chemistry teacher. I don't know anything about science. I don't believe in science. No. I know nothing about science. So I don't necessarily have the skill set that Walter White does to become a great maker of crystal meth.
Right.
But there is a certain amount of this is a normal person. Your point about the worlds of The Wire and The Sopranos, where this is the culture these people are already surrounded by. Mm-hmm. I do think that makes this a different show. He has absolutely made a conscious decision. I mean, that's the title of the show, is this decision that he has made and how far that decision takes him. So absolutely, it is a much more complex moral universe because so many mob movies and crime movies, it's just these are shows about criminals.
Right.
There's a comparison that I made a while ago in writing about Breaking Bad and saying that for me, Breaking Bad is a show that has always been really interested in the morality of individuals, mm-hmm. whereas The Wire was much more interested in the morality of systems.
Sure.
The ethic of The Wire, to me, was that the morality of a system will always overwhelm the morality of an individual in the vast majority of cases. Mm-hmm. So that even if you are, like you said, a good kid, you can slide into a certain path because the system is immoral. So even the good people have a tendency to slide because the real interest on the part of David Simon is always in the morality of systems. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that individual characters don't make choices, and it doesn't mean that those choices can't be wrenching and important. But I think you're right, and maybe this is, I hadn't thought about it with The Sopranos because I only watched, to be honest, some of The Sopranos. Mm-hmm. But it may be that in a way, The Sopranos is also more interested in the morality of the system. In other words, this system of violence into which the people are born, where for me, Breaking Bad has always been a story that was fascinated by the morality of individuals. And it was not just Walt, but the changes that took place in other characters, Jesse, Skyler, people like that, where what they believed and what they would do and wouldn't do was shifting a certain amount and was affected by what was going on with them. And so I think that's sort of similar to what you're getting at, just kind of a different way of thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. I was struck by, you know, this notion of the anti-hero, which everybody's now saying, oh, I'm so sick of the anti-hero. I'm so sick of the white privileged anti-hero. It struck me that even in a lot of narratives that feature anti-heroes, there's a villain who is even worse because, you need your protagonist to have an antagonist. Mm-hmm. So like in this case, and this is a mild spoiler for the last half, like season and a half of Breaking Bad, but they're Nazis.
Yeah.
Nazis.
We found like the one demographic worse than Walter White.
It's like the rules of narrative still apply. Even with an anti-hero, you need somebody much worse.
Yeah. It is interesting to ponder whether we're going to be moving into a different kind of drama. Because if you look at some things that are successful now, like The Walking Dead and even Game of Thrones,
that's where
the
zombies are up against communists.
You're not really seeing what you were seeing for a while, which was really over and over and over again. The big major dramas were centered around an individual angry dude. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether or not you can technically apply the term anti-hero, I think is, you know, there are some things about that term that perhaps are a little too slippery in some of these discussions.
Yeah, but not for something like Low Winter Sun.
Right. But I think, I do want to point out, if you haven't read, Todd Vanderwerf wrote a thing recently about Breaking Bad as an examination of privilege that I thought was very, very smart and really put his finger on something about Walter White that I don't think was ever explicit, but was always implicit, which is he was driven from the beginning not by desperation, as some of his bigger fans are fond of saying, mm-hmm. not by desperation and the fact that he had no choice because he didn't have insurance. He was driven by a sense of seething entitlement mm-hmm. and anger that he hadn't gotten his, that he deserved to be more respected, more important, more deferred to.
Right.
So we'll link to that piece. I think Todd absolutely put his finger on it.
Well, I do think there's a real strong element of truth to that. But there's some humiliation tied up in his psyche in those early episodes.
Right.
That
absolutely
true. That I recall. You know, his students don't respect him. His, you know, he eventually has to take a part-time job or something, right, before mm-hmm. all this
yeah,
happens.
Yeah, there's kind of a falling down quality to, the guy who just keeps getting kicked and kicked and kicked.
And then when the moment comes and he turns, it's almost like he comes alive. I was going to say, to me, you got your flawed heroes, you got your anti-heroes, and then you have your bona fide charismatic villains. Mm-hmm. And to me, a lot of the time that I spent with Walter in those early seasons anyway, he was being a charismatic villain. He was still on the rise. Mm-hmm. He's going from success to success. He's making narrow escape after narrow escape.
Right.
And it reminded me of the first act or the first act and a large chunk of the second act of Richard III, mm-hmm. where you've got this guy who is incredibly charming. And you side with him in part because of the brio and the relish with which he just sort of digs into this villainy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and also with that character, it helps, I guess, narratively that he is doomed. Mm-hmm. You know that he is doomed. He is proclaimed in the first episode of the series to be dying. And in a way, it does change the stakes for that character.
Sure.
And I think it's very interesting about that show that a lot of the questions looming about the show as it carried on was not what will happen to Walter White, because he is careening in that direction no matter what decision he has made. So the stakes are different for him.
Right.
But what are the stakes for the people he loves and cares
about? That's what a lot of these discussions about, oh, he's such a badass.
He's endangering his family.
Completely ignored. I can say this much. The finale is cathartic in a very simple, straightforward sense. if you assume that the universe ceases to exist when the show exists, if you think for a second that people's lives continue after that, it becomes a much sadder, much more soul-destroying kind of ending. But we went back and saw the very first episode right before we saw the last, and it was, I think, mildly revelatory because... it's not, this is why I mentioned the volition that I mentioned, because you can see he had lots of choices.
There were
lots of things that he had to do. And the first time he sees the money is before he's, as
I
Linda
mentioned this on Twitter,
The first time he sees the money is before he's diagnosed, and you can just see this greed.
This hunger for this, you know, he sees a pile of drug money from a bust. And it's essentially this moment of like, oh,
want.
Yes, it's that. It's that.
Yeah.
And
not need, want.
Not. Right. And I watched the pilot right before the finale as well. And one of the things that was so interesting to me is that there has been so much reverse engineering of this character, partly because of how sympathetically he's been played. And I mean that as a compliment. I don't mean that as like a, you know, it's BS because he's played sympathetically. The way he's played by Bryan Cranston, there has been a certain amount of reverse engineering to go back and say, this was an act of desperation, this was an act of whatever. Mm. He says, in the first episode, he says, I'm awake. When Jesse says to him, what is going on with you? He says,
I am awake.
And he feels great, and he goes home and he can finally have sex with his wife. Yeah. Like, this is not something that he's doing strictly out of desperation. Is there, you know, yes, it's almost an excuse. Mm-hmm. Like, now I desperately need money. And I'm going to die anyway. That's a great question of whether the cancer diagnosis is more important because it makes him think I need money to provide for my family. Or is it more important because it makes him think now it doesn't matter what I do, so I can chase this feeling that I
had. That's a sense I got in a big, big way.
So I can chase this feeling that I had the minute I saw that drug money. Yeah. My question about him is I think it's interesting that he didn't lose more people over the course of the show. Mm-hmm. And he didn't lose me. I, you know, partly because there are other people.
Oh, you mean
in
lose,
whom to
lose
be invested.
Viewers.
The audience's
sympathy, right? Yeah. The audience's investment in the character.
And I think it's a salute to some of the other people they were able to build up as, you know, particularly Jesse, as a character that you just were. To me, by the time they got to the finale, I was mostly invested in him.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting that more people didn't sort of say, I don't want to watch this unpleasant show about this unpleasant person, because you get that even in much lower stakes movies. You can get that in movies about selfish rich people, mm-hmm. where people say, I don't want to watch this movie because, you know, a lot of people feel that way about like Whit Stillman movies.
Right.
Like, for example, me.
Right. And it's like, you know, he's making a movie where the protagonist is this really unpleasant person. I, in a way, had this problem with Enough Said with the Julia Louis-Dreyfus character. And she's certainly a lot nicer as a person than Walter White. Uh-huh. It is an interesting phenomenon what unsympathetic protagonists do and do not do to your willingness to engage.
Well, and the level of charisma of the character is a big part of that.
Yeah, that's what you were saying.
I couldn't look away from Aaron Paul's face from the moment he was on screen in the first episode. My immediate reaction was, I just want to roll around in this performance.
Yeah.
And so even if everybody's bad, I'm so fascinated by that kid.
You're going to keep coming back for that guy.
Yeah.
What Linda was saying about a spectrum of willingness to put up with unsympathy, has a raced and gendered dynamic to it that I think has only barely been explored in this context. I saw a couple of interesting essays in the last week or so that talked about why we're willing to stick with a character like Walter White or a character like Tony Soprano or other charismatic but wicked men. Mm-hmm. When
Omar in The Wire,
mm-hmm. When the lead character in Scandal, for instance, gets all kinds of grief about not being an upright, virtuous black woman.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and I think in fairness, part of the reason for that is that when you present a woman who's unsympathetic, you have to do it sort of sideways. And what annoys me about Scandal is always that I think she's a terrible person, but she gets sort of marketed and treated like she's a heroine. And I think the show has not been completely honest about what a selfish, rotten person she is. Whereas a show like, you know, The Sopranos not necessarily throws you into the person being a rotten person, but is very straightforward about the moral compromises that they're making, whereas I feel like Scandal is so into romanticizing her. And I think that's one thing that happens, is that you see, you know, women, it's like you have to present them like they're nice. And so when they're actually jerks, you feel like this is a big con job. Mm-hmm. Whereas somebody like Walter White, they're going to come right out and say, hey, you know what? Anti-hero, mm-hmm. right? At any rate, you should come and find us on Facebook. And don't say anything specific about the Breaking Bad yes. finale. That would be so sad.
Yeah,
that would be so sad.
We managed to keep that discussion very spoiler-free.
Quite spoiler-free.
I'm proud of you guys.
Good for us. Mm-hmm. Quite spoiler-free.
Everybody's dead.
But Trey does not have any information about the show, so
true.
Trey is being a goof.
Most of my knowledge of the show is about, was it Stuvia commercials?
Yes.
Yeah. Stevia?
I admit I had to Google Stevia today to find out why everybody was tweeting about it.
I've retained enough of it to not remember the name of the product.
At any rate. Come and find us on Facebook. Talk about finales or anti-heroes or protagonists that you can or cannot stick with. And we will be happy to take your comments. And in 5 years, Stephen will respond. Mm-hmm. So speaking of bad people and sticking with bad people. Uh-huh.
Talking about our next topic and not me.
Exactly. Our other topic today, we were going to talk a little bit about games today. Now, some of you may know, many of you may know. In fact, many of you probably do know, given the popularity of Grand Theft Auto 5. But Grand Theft Auto 5 came out a little while ago.
September 17th.
Thank you, Stephen Thompson. And
my research did not include actually playing the game.
And as far as I know, one of us has played it.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be surprised when I tell you, it's me! So
let's put this in context.
I can leave the room now, right? Because my last gaming console was a Radio Shack TRS-80 color computer.
No, you and I are going to have a great time. They'll talk about their precious Grand Theft Auto 5, and I will talk Q-Bert.
Yeah. Let's put this in context. More people bought Grand Theft Auto 5 on its first day than have ever watched Breaking Bad.
No, it's true. Yeah.
and paid $60.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, so let me put this in context for myself. I run a pop culture blog.
Mm-hmm.
Pop culture blog. Did not have a gaming console. Got to the point where I was like, that's dumb.
Right.
That ain't gonna work. I fear obsolescence, people. You gotta get in there, right? So I started to talk to people about if I were gonna get one, which one should I get? Of course, the current choices being mostly for this purpose an Xbox 360 or a PS3,
and not the Wii, which is sort of like bowling
for this purpose.
For
this
purpose.
So I start to go back and forth with people, and of course, it comes out that but they're both gonna put out new ones in the next few months, so. You really should wait. And a couple of people saying, really you should wait like another year after that because then we'll know which one is better and then there will be more good games. And I eventually got to the point where I was like, look, I fear obsolescence much faster than that. So
you still have a flip phone.
Right. I was like, we're just going to have to get on with it. So, and the other thing is now if you buy like a PS3, they're a little more reasonably priced.
Yep.
And also the games are, I would guess, going to come down in price for a while and then be available used and blah, 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 and so forth.
And if you're always 5 years behind the technology, it's still going to dazzle you.
I was going to say, it's not my goal to necessarily be on the like bleeding edge of gaming. It's just my goal to understand this part of the world a little bit better.
Yeah.
So this is how I came to have a PS3 and Grand Theft Auto 5. Okay. So a pacifist's adventure in Grand Theft Auto 5.
Quaker plays Grand Theft Auto
And I will 5. Say... I have only played the very beginning of this game.
How many missions?
I basically played the prologue mission before the credits, right?
So you've walked to the car.
No. There's a whole thing. Yeah. You have to
find the car in the parking lot.
There's a whole thing you get. You start off in a I guess it's a bank, and you're robbing the bank, and then you have to survive a shootout with the police. And a drive to the helicopter that's supposed to be rescuing you. So, I have essentially played the prologue over and over again because, and you know, Glenn doesn't want me to sort of revel in the dilettante parts, and I am not going to.
Well,
but you do sort of it is a good way to sort of get used to like how to manipulate everything. And I got to tell you, if you grew up playing video games where there's like a joystick and a button. When you get that PS3 controller that has six things that you're supposed to be running at the same time, it really does have six.
Yeah.
Well, no, actually seven things that you're using relatively frequently. That's actually sort of difficult. I mean, that's a
no,
lot
this,
of...
this is a gigantic barrier to entry for me.
It is a lot to get used to.
The sunk costs that go into learning how to play these games,
and
it's basically like learning a language.
Right. I'm not trying to be like, ooh, I couldn't drive the car. I mean,
it's just
that it takes some getting used to.
It
so
does.
There's partly
it's
that.
It's muscle memory. You'll get it.
There's partly that. But I got to say... it's sort of fun. It is sort of fun and kind of fascinating because I get into it, right? I'm doing the initial thing and I'm trying to survive the shootout and I realize that I am much less troubled by it than I thought I might be, right? And all of a sudden I'm shooting at police officers and I'm like, oh, wait, that guy's coming out from behind the car. And I'm thinking about how insidious it is because they start you off with a mission where, A, you are outnumbered, you and your two dudes because there's three of you. They're all dudes. You cannot be a lady.
No, they have women. They have bikinis. So.
Yeah, but you can't play a woman.
Yeah.
So you and your two dudes are hopelessly outnumbered by all these police officers who are shooting at you also. So they work you into it in like the most justified way in which you could ever be shooting a bunch of police officers. So I realize that
clearly
they're...
no jury in the world.
Right, which is one of the questions we had talked about addressing, and I'm not sure if we actually addressed it in segment number one, which was, why is it so easy to identify with and get on board with these anti-heroes, right?
Yeah.
So here we are.
And this is kind of where I started to actually find this fascinating, which is I started to think, okay, so I'm anti-violence, right? Mm-hmm. Why is that? And I realized it's because I tend to – it's not because I'm perfectly fine with people shooting me. It's because I tend to assume you generally have other options.
Right?
You can avoid the situation in the first place. You can turn yourself in to the police officers. You can...
I like the notion that there's a wing of Grand Theft Auto V where you can just go in and play Sims.
where the justice system works.
You just decide to stay at home, raise your kids.
Stay with me. This is my exact point. In real life... I am against violence in part because I think you generally have other options, right? Try to negotiate, leave the situation,
don't
whatever.
Rob the bank. Yeah.
Well, right. Okay, but don't purely mock. Stay with me a little bit.
I know where she's going.
Part of what makes this interesting is that the way they set up this game is that they remove all your choices.
Right.
They constrain your choices and they put you in a position where, first of all, the police are going to shoot you. They're not going to capture you.
Right.
They are going to shoot you. No matter what you do, you put your hands. You can't put your hands up and
there's
give
not
in
a seventh button
and
that surrenders.
There's not a surrender button, so it constrains all your choices. You can't leave your guys, so you can't say, "Look, you guys worry about this. I'm running." You can't. It'll blow you up just like you died.
Yep.
You are constrained. You cannot choose to leave the situation. You cannot choose not to get into the situation. You cannot choose any path other than the one they're saying. You know, you play this mission by doing this path in this way.
Right.
You go from here to there. And if you don't follow the rules of it, you'll get killed.
Right.
And it's like it constrains your choices so much that it upends kind of what your feelings about violence are in this way that it actually works a little bit funny on your brain because I didn't have any I'm sitting there. I'm having a shootout. Right. Thinking, I'm just having a shootout. What can I do? What can I do? Having a shootout.
Thursday.
And then I realize that when I shoot one and the little video game character has been shot but is still alive, I find it very uncomfortable to shoot him again.
Yeah. Oh, God.
There are little pings active.
Take a headshot. It's the humane thing to do.
Always got to double tap, Linda. Double tap.
Double tap.
I have this. I have this same problem, incidentally, in the game Mr. Do, where you are a little clown with a ball, and then these little, like little duck-like creatures are chasing you around.
See, everybody's making fun of me, but I actually think this is part of how it works on people.
You're still on the training mission, so as you get deeper and deeper into the game, what's going to happen is that each mission is going to have multiple ways, because it is an open world. So it's going to have multiple ways to accomplish the objective,
right.
But you'll still need to do X, Y, and Z. You need to have to get these bullet points. I have found, and I played every Grand Theft Auto game, every one, and, you know, it's not targeted for me. I mean, peak experience with a Grand Theft Auto game is to be a straight, white, 14-year-old boy.
Right.
For this to be some level of wish fulfillment.
Yeah, right. Well, sure.
Not the shooting people part, but the high-rolling...
Right, and so, for
not
example...
not even that high-rolling.
What's...
They're kind of toothless criminals.
But don't you
now,
work your way
yeah,
up?
You get
I'm sure you
criminal
do.
Society.
Now,
yeah.
So the game is not targeted to me. I'm asked to do things that I wouldn't do. For
right.
example, in the last game, one of the missions is you have to go to a strip club, get a lap dance.
This is the American dream.
Get information from the stripper and then leave. So, it's just, I swear, the connection you feel with your guy, you know, your avatar there on the screen, is as you acclimate to this world, Linda, you're going to find that that connection is real. I swear to God, when he got that mission, you could see my guy's shoulders slump. Just a little bit. And when I walk into the...
I don't want to go to a strip club.
When I walk into the strip club, I intentionally made him go in very slowly. Like, if I could have had him kick a pebble, like, boom, whatever. And one thing I automatically did was I made sure he touched no surfaces in there. Like, take a wide berth around the banquette, touch nothing that is organic or inorganic. And so I go in, the lap dance happens, and I just... It feels gross. So, like, afterwards, I really wanted to, like, press Y to take a cleansing shower.
Press Z to apologize.
Hit R1 to patronize a feminist bookstore. I would be, like, spamming that button. Like, but connection
again,
is
not,
real,
right?
Right?
Yeah, it is oddly immersive, and I am very glad that I did not take the approach of it of standing back and saying, this is gross, this is a first-person shooter, I would never play it. Would I play it purely for pleasure for a long time? I don't know, but it is, even on a training mission, this is exactly my point, even at the very beginning, mm-hmm. it is instantly a really interesting experience mm-hmm.
And
me.
It is because it is immersive that even though I enjoy Grand Theft Auto and I enjoy Skyrim, I have deliberately, because I'm writing a book, I deliberately said I'm not going to get it. I can't because it just will eat all my time.
You come to my house.
No. I mean, okay. So that'll put a nice little cap around.
That would
that'll
be okay.
Be fine.
That'd
as
be
long
good.
As there's a time box.
Absolutely.
I was going to say. You should come again and find us on Facebook and tell us about your favorite games. And I'm sure that we will have many more things like this to talk about as I become slightly less illiterate at Grand Theft Auto. And perhaps learn to drive.
Good.
Because I did crash the car.
Good.
Quite a lot.
That's part of the deal.
I crashed the car a lot.
You gotta crash a few cars.
That's true. And that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, it's something I've been thinking about for a while, and it was perfectly illustrated and crystallized in a tweet last night by a TV writer named David Slack, and I'm quoting here. Vince Gilligan, creator of Breaking Bad, is known across the industry as a very nice guy. Remember that the next time people say bad behavior is the price of genius. And I just love that is one of the takeaway lessons of Breaking Bad.
Mm-hmm.
That this guy, I've never heard a bad word spoken about Vince Gilligan.
Me neither.
And we've all been around difficult creative types in our lives. And it seems like there's been a little bit of a mini wave of people in entertainment who are renowned for being nice guys. There's this that saying, nice guys finish last,
mm-hmm.
is one of my least favorite sayings in all of the English language, because it is this delusional propaganda by a coalition of the not nice and people who finish last. and so you have, you know, and
I've heard you say that before, and I still love it.
It's one of the things that I say. But, you know, watching the Emmys, you know, the weekend before last, where the Colbert Report won, and one of the people who hired me at The Onion won an Emmy for being executive producer of The Colbert Report, Rich Dom, who is one of the nicest people I have ever met, let alone worked with. Mm-hmm. And seeing him bounding down the aisle with a gigantic grin on his face mm-hmm. is just one of the best things that's happened to me in the last few weeks. And I just, you know, what's making me happy this week is this little wave of good things happening to good people because Excellent. It does happen.
Excellent. I thank you, Thompson. That's a good one. Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week?
Users who hate me.
There you go.
User feedback. Last week, when we were talking about cello sounds and only one available version of something,
no.
I interrupted Stephen to name the thing he was talking about, and I got it wrong.
This is
I said
the same thing that happened with, was it Rilo Kiley's? Yeah.
And the thing is, I knew that I got it wrong as soon as I said it, but I didn't want to stop the taping and make you all, you know, let me interrupt Stephen again. I said Bach cello variations. It is, of course, the Bach cello suites.
Oh, heaven what
is Fend. What is making me happy is that there are not one but two pop culture happy hour nerds who corrected me on Twitter and called me out and demanded a formal correction. So here you are.
And called you names right. and were horrible
and
to you.
And were right. awful to you.
But what's really making, really truly making me happy is another bit of feedback from a user who said, if you're looking for something to make you happy this week, let me remind you of this. And it is something I had been looking at, and I had watched the trailers and a couple of excerpts and scenes, and I now am going to go and sit down and watch much more of it. The Hollow Crown on PBS.
Oh, yes, that.
It is the four
yeah,
plays.
Yeah, I fell down on the job not telling you about that.
Yeah. Oh. The four plays of the Henriad.
Four plays.
Yes. all four. From Richard II through Henry V. You ask how that can be four plays because Henry IV is the only one in between, but it comes in part one and part two. Mm. The cast is kind of extraordinary. It's Ben Whishaw playing Richard II. Jeremy Irons is Henry IV. And our own Tom Hiddleston is Henry V.
Our own, meaning
our
Trey.
Own. He works at NPR.
Yeah. No, just
well,
me.
He's a friend of the podcast. Also, Michelle Dockery from Downton Abbey is uh-huh. in this, and the I believe the sort of the boss of bosses in this this very long epic production, which was staged, which was put together and filmed rather for the BBC as part of the Olympics to do back last year. Sam Mendes is a guy in charge of it all. So.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Very true. All right, Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Two things, a fake thing and a real thing. The fake thing is that I did what I said I would not do. In 2011, I did a Twitter hashtag called During the Government Shutdown, and it was fun. But then I think, like last year, there was like a furlough or something, mm-hmm. and people were asking me if I was going to do it again. And I said at the time, yeah, it would be the same joke. I'm not going to do that. I don't want to do the same joke again. Well, I got over that pretty quickly. And now that there's an actual government shutdown looming, I went back and I wanted to make it clear that it was a sequel. So mm-hmm. I toyed with a couple possible hashtags.
Yeah, you test drove a couple of hashtags.
During the Government Shutdown 2, Legend of Curly's Gold.
Excellent.
During the Government Shutdown 2, The Secret of the Ooze. During the Government Shutdown 2, Their First Assignment. Police Academy.
Yep. Waiting for Electric Boogaloo.
Ah, well, that is the hack
that's,
choice.
That is
the obvious choice. Too easy. I ended up with... During the Government Shutdown 2, Pig in the City, because it's the shortest, and also because Babe, Pig in the City is a great movie.
Right?
Okay, so what I've effectively done is chopped the amount of space available to me to make these dumb jokes by a third.
Right.
So, and let me tell you, you can't even get a premise in. It's like 99 characters, I think, is what I got.
You're constrained, the greater your art.
Yeah. So I'm going to stop it once the actual shutdown hits.
Let's hope.
Yeah, because I mean, I think the time when basic services are not being done, it's not the time for yuck yucks. So
right.
I'm gonna
becomes
put it
less
away.
Funny.
Becomes less funny. And you know, so I'm having some fun with it. People have been writing to me going, "Oh, looks like you're just doing Welcome to Night Vale." And let me just say, Welcome to Night Vale is great. The writing on that is perfect. But this is a thing that was done in 2011. First, so I mean, those whelps didn't create the dumb Lovecraft joke. They have just
right.
merely perfected it. Anyway, the real thing is a web comic called Something Terrible by a guy named Dean Tripp, T-R-I-P-P-E. It's a web comic. It's 18 pages long. It's 99 cents. The best 99 cents you are going to spend. It's an autobiographical comic about something terrible that happened to him as a kid. And we were talking about heroes and anti-heroes in particular. I have been writing this book, of course, about nerd culture and the role of Batman in it. And I've been asking people, so why Batman? What is it about Batman? What is it about this character? This comic is the most eloquent response to that question I'm ever going to get. It is so spare and moving and haunting and incredibly well constructed. And it's basically about the power of this very silly idea of people dressing up in outfits and wailing on each other to protect us, to give us agency, to inspire, but also to give us, to rescue us in a very real way, an emotional way. A psychological way, a mental way, not instead of physically, but the power of these characters to lift us up. It's great. So it's Something Terrible by Dean Tripp. Pick it up.
Excellent. Well, you know, Glenn Weldon, I had hashtag two last week.
Yeah.
I had
a
hashtag two.
That's true.
If you saw 300 feminist sandwiches, that was me. And it came from the lady who wrote the blog about how she's making 300 sandwiches to get her boyfriend to propose. Ugh. And mostly it just allowed a lot of really awesome sandwich jokes. That's that's basically the only reason it was done. It was
almost
not
redundant,
done,
Linda Holmes, right. Awesome sandwich jokes.
It wasn't done out of hostility or bitterness or anything like that. I just thought it would be funny. And it was. And it,
I think my favorite was Ruben and the yeah. with a Y.
Yeah, there were many, many very, very good ones.
Our banh mi ourselves.
That was a favorite. There were many that were, you know, and the great thing about that was I did two. I did two and then I just pushed it into the universe and everyone else just went and it was great and it was wonderful. So that's my first thing. My two real things are I went this past Saturday to design camp with my friend Annabeth Chow, who you may know from the internet as AB Chow, C-H-A-O. And Annabeth had a bunch of stuff going on, which she's written about on the blog. She had a death in the family and some other things going on. What she does is she is a very talented designer. She does like interior design for people. She does decorating and things. And she throws these little one-day sessions where you go and she teaches you all about how to decorate your place and pick paint and all this stuff. And despite the fact that I already did my painting, I do have this new apartment. So I went and Annabeth gave all these little classes about how to set up your lamps and it was just wonderful. And I do recommend it very highly. And it's not Zach's on roll because you can take advantage of it. Mm-hmm. If you go to
on Craigslist and buy a Zach's on machine.
If you go to Annabeth's blog and or if you follow her on Twitter at abchao, A-B-C-H-A-O, you can find out all about Design Camp. My other just really quick thing is finally, after a long delay, I got my cable installed, uh-huh. Got my DVR up and running. And the biggest difference between me when I have a DVR and me when I don't is that I watch late-night television when I have a DVR because I watch it in the morning over breakfast and coffee. And that got me back watching some of my favorite late-night shows and got me to start watching Kamau Bell's show, uh-huh. which has been on – they just recently moved it on FXX to weeknightly instead of once a week. And also watching lots of Jimmy Fallon. So Jimmy Fallon, the two things I would mention are Kamau Bell is – I don't necessarily – it's very much like Jimmy Fallon. I don't like him when he stands there and tells jokes uh-huh. necessarily, but he does great bits. Like he did a great bit going out and talking to people about their differing experiences with the police, uh-huh. which was – like his sensibility is really cool and interesting to have in the mix, and he's done some great, great stuff. So Kamau Bell's show and Jimmy Fallon's show – they had a particularly really good episode last week where the Avett brothers were on. They did a bit with Justin Timberlake. And in my personal favorite part, they had a lip sync off with Jimmy Fallon, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and Stephen Merchant, in which Stephen Merchant sang Boom Shake the Room. And Jimmy Fallon sang Take on Me and Oh Gosh. And then Joseph Gordon-Levitt winds up singing Super Bass. It's really good. If you have not seen the lip sync off, it absolutely made my week. And it was just one of those high energy things. It's unexpected. There's a wonderful moment where Joseph Gordon-Levitt is doing Super Bass and the Roots are in the background. And you can see like the guys in the Roots just with their jaws, like literally their mouths are hanging open because they're so shocked at what he is doing lip syncing Super Bass. So late night television, interior decorating, feminist sandwiches. All kinds of things are theoretically making me happy this week.
Theoretically. If I weren't so miserable, these things would be making me happy.
These are the things that are supposed to be making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham, like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our producer, Nick Fountain, at Nick Fountain, Nick like Nick, Fountain like Fountain. You can follow our esteemed producer, Emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.